Go ahead and begin. You should have an outline of the fourth class that we have. We've looked at the arguments for the existence of God in the last two lectures, and tonight we are broaching the subject of creation versus evolution. And that's what chapter 4 in our textbook is entitled. And so I want to look at these two. They're two opposing worldviews. And basically, they're the only two options. Either the world did come about by its own, or either it was created. The first one is creation. And that would mean that this universe and all that is therein was created by some supernatural process that is not now taking place. And of course it would imply that there had to be something supernatural to do that. That is God. It had to have a supernatural creator. And that he's not doing that now. So God made a man out of mud at one point. He's not doing it now. God spoke the world into existence at one point. He's not doing it now. And of course this is consistent with the law of biogenesis that's talked about in the textbook. The law of biogenesis basically is a scientific law that says life comes from life. And it's interesting how you have very educated laws that really just point out sometimes to us very obvious things, common sense things, right? Non-life never gives birth to life, does it? We don't ever see any examples of that. How would that happen? But life always gives birth to life. Life doesn't come from non-life. And of course, this is consistent with what the Bible says. Remember when the world was created, that God created everything, and he made it to produce after its own kind, right? Genesis 1, verses 11 and 12. The Bible says, and God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb-yielding seed, the fruit-yielding fruit, after his kind, whose seed is in itself. And it was so, and the earth brought forth grass and herb-yielding seed after his kind. And tree-yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good. So this shows a couple things that are true, that are going to really be devastating to this case of evolution as we get into this study. But the fact that life gives birth to life and that things produce after their own kind. That is, one kind of animal does not produce another kind of animal. And one kind of plant does not produce another kind of plant. And then you also have verse 21 and verses 24 and 25 there that you can read as well. And so creation would be the first worldview, that this world was created by a creator. And of course that's what Paul says. That was what his argument was in Acts 14 and Acts 17. That's what the Bible points to as clear evidence that God exists. The other worldview, which is opposed to creation, is what we're going to be studying more in detail tonight, and that is evolution. And evolution would be that the universe, all that is in it, has come into existence by natural and innate processes, which are still at work and can be observed. So, and what I mean by innate processes is the fact that whatever the creating power or whatever force it was that has brought us to this point is part of the system itself. You know, the system itself that created itself. Its creating power is innate or born in part of the system that it has created. And that you can continue to observe this today. I mean, there's no reason, if evolution is the cause for all of this, that it's not continually happening. And that's exactly what people suggest today. That's exactly why certain leaders, like Hitler and others, have taken the idea of natural selection, and because we're moving on. We're going to develop a master race. And so they submit that the reason you can know this is because you can observe it still today. Now, this gets into some more specifics, and I want to go over these four points with you. Number one, the living creatures existing today are descendants of different living creatures which existed in the past. So they point to dinosaurs as one of the proofs, you know, for this. But we don't have the species today that it's not like we've always had them, is what they're suggesting, right? That there were, along the span of time, there was some little amoeba here and gave birth to a bunch of things more and more and more complex. And somehow it's all branched out, so to speak, across the span of time. And so what we have today is just the notes, just the tips of all this evolutionary chain of events of billions of years of, you know, the generations and generations becoming more and more complex. That's the idea. So during this time, there are evidently, according to them, some creatures which are very different from what we see today. That would be the first point. Secondly, all of these creatures owe their existence to one single-celled organism, which in turn would owe its existence to something that is not living. You know, that's the question that they can't answer. Even if you could point out that all of this goes back to one living creature that has a single cell, where did that come from? Where did the first living cell come from? I mean, that to me is a bigger gap than all of this, because you have to have non-life giving birth to life. And so that would come from non-living matter, and then they can't even explain how that came about. And so that's point number two. Now, point number three, this process that's brought all this diversity of creatures that are existing today has been gradual, so to speak. And so that if you were able to survey every creature that has ever existed on the face of the earth throughout the span of history of the universe, that you could lay them and show them side by side, so to speak, and you could show how there was a gradual increase in complexity, and you could really see the development of all the different creatures that we have today. And there are certain lines of development and the similarities that are existent in different kingdom and phyla and class. And so that's the third point, that this is a gradual thing, that you could show the development all the way along the way from that first single-cell organism to even man, or whatever animal that we have existing today. And then, last of all, that this is all done by time and chance. If you just throw enough time at it, you'll over the time, you'll just have, chances will be right that it'll finally take place. And so that's the more specifics of things of the worldview of evolution. Now, in the chapter, it does point out something that I think is very important for us to think about when we think about evolution and the word evolution. And this is point two on our handout. When we think about evolution, we talk about evolution, it's used in different ways. Every word is used in different ways, in different contexts. And when we talk about the evolution of creatures, there's a big difference between two different kinds. There is something that is called special evolution, and that's not what we're going to be really talking about so much in this lecture, except for what we're going to be talking about it for right now. Special evolution is also called microevolution, and it is something that you can observe. It is something that you can show. It's something that you can test. No creationist doubts special evolution. What special evolution is changes in the characteristics of a certain kind of animal, right? For instance, we have new breeds of dogs that people are able to make, right? We haven't always had certain dogs that we have today. We haven't had all the breeds. But dogs can be bred for certain uses. And so, obviously, you can point out that, you know, if you group this group together, they're going to produce this type of offspring. And we don't deny that at all. You can show that. It's very testable. It's very observable. But there are certain limits to that, right? No matter how much you try to breed dogs, you're not going to get an elephant out of it. You're not going to get a fruit fly out of it, right? You're always going to get a dog. Even, it can be all the way down to a chihuahua, a little toy chihuahua, or it can be a Great Dane that, you know, comes up to my hip or my chest. It's still going to be a dog. It's not going to be some other kind. And so, when we talk about that type of evolution, that can be proven. That is fact. But what the evolutionists and the atheists that really propagate this stuff do is they'll give that as an example and say evolution is a fact. And then they'll turn around and use evolution and have in reference this other evolution. And so really there's double talk, because they'll talk about something that's fact and then they'll turn around and talk about, they use the same word, but what they mean is not special evolution. They mean general evolution, the general theory of evolution. That's what we're going to be talking about the rest of this lecture. This is also called macroevolution. Micro meaning small, macro meaning big. And this would mean a creation of a new kind of animal. And this is what we're suggesting here, that this single-celled animal developed into more and more complex features until eventually, you know, they split off into these branches that we have here. And there were new species that were developed, and there were new kinds and new classes of animals that were all developed along the lines of the billions of years that this took place. And so this is what people usually think of when you say the word evolution. So if somebody says you believe in evolution, they're probably thinking this, but you ought to get things straight. You ought to make sure that you know what you're talking about. And don't just assume that they're talking about one or the other. What kind of evolution are you talking about? And so we're going to focus with problems with macroevolution, the general theory of evolution. And we have the handouts I have here, they're from this book, Tornado in a Junkyard, which is a pretty good book for some of this stuff. The first problem that we have with macroevolution, by the way, feel free to make any comments or observations that you have, is the fossil record. And the interesting thing is most people, I guess, generally believe that the fossil record is the basis or the proof behind the whole scheme, right? That you have these paleontologists, they're looking these things up, and they're digging these things up, and shouldn't they prove this whole transition from the single cell to... Well, the fact is, they really don't provide the proof. In fact, they provide more proof for creation, and they really do disprove this general theory of evolution. You say, how so? Well, when you look at the fossils that we have in the world today, the fossils that we have are basically of things that we find today. You know, we have species, types of animals that are existing today, and we have, of course, we have dinosaurs and things that have gone extinct. But you would expect that if through a process of billions and billions of years, that somehow from this single-celled amoeba, we develop all the way up to something as complex as man, that you're going to have some transitional form, right? You're going to have something that is halfway in between, at least at some point, right? Because it's a gradual process, and it takes millions and millions of years to develop each one of these species. And there have been times in the past where people have tried to show this. Of course, you know, they can draw it. The artist can draw a thing, but showing the proof is different. For instance, where's the proof that shows the half man, half ape? Where's the proof that shows that there's a half amphibian, half fish, or a half reptile, half bird? You would expect that there would be a lot of transitional forms. And in fact, Charles Darwin himself recognized that this is one of the biggest problems that could be levied against his theory. He said this, I quote, He said, why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? That's what we're talking about. Something that would be kind of between these species that we see, or these kinds of animals that we see. Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. So the gradual thing that we're talking about, it doesn't reveal that. And this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. The explanation lies, I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geological record. Of course, during his time, paleontology was a lot younger, but now we have done more than just scratch the surface. We have millions and millions of fossils, and yet what we're finding is more and more of the same species. That, you know, I don't know if when I was taught science in school and taught these things in school, we had something called the Cambrian explosion. Somehow all these species just show up and we don't have any record of them before them. Doesn't that seem more like creation than it would the gradual process of, you know, growing more and more complex, right? And so he goes through several in this book, and you also in our textbook, several examples of asking people that world-renowned paleontologists, world-renowned experts of fossil museums, and asking them, will you provide for us something that would show an intermediate link? And they simply say, we can't give you one. That would, you know, be a watertight argument. If you look at this first handout here, the pictures you see on your left, the top one is this fossil that is of a fish that they said had some limbs that would be similar to an amphibian. Now, the way that they basically said this developed, we'll look at that more in detail in a little bit, but, you know, they said that it first of all it started with invertebrates, which would be like seashells, jellyfish, things like that, and then it developed to vertebrates in the sea, like fish. And then after that, the fish got tired of being in water, and so they developed little limbs where they could, you know, after struggling for millions of years, that they could get outside of water but still be near it, like amphibians. Then amphibians went to reptiles after that. Then reptiles developed into birds, and, you know, so on. And then mammals came later on, and then man. And so this is what was a proposed link between fish and amphibians, them having these maybe little legs, right? And they say, see, this is extinct now, and here's a halfway amphibian, halfway fish. Well, just about, I guess, 70 years ago, they caught one of these off the coast of Madagascar. It was very embarrassing for the evolutionists, because it proves two things. First of all, these aren't extinct. This intermediate form is still existent. And second of all, they were able to examine it, and it's not an intermediate form at all. It's just a fish. It doesn't have any limbs like an amphibian, like they suggested. And so, much to their chagrin, that this thing was caught. They said that it existed 70 million years ago and was extinct, and yet it's living today. And it's a fish, and it doesn't have any limbs that it could move on the land with. This second one here on the right, the purported link between reptiles and birds, a famous one called Archaeopteryx. And they said that Archaeopteryx had feathers like a bird would have, but he also had teeth and claws, and so he showed there that there's the reptile slash bird. Well, first of all, that's assuming quite a bit, because just because a bird might have claws in its wings doesn't mean that it's part reptile. For instance, the ostrich has claws in its wings. Does that mean that it's part reptile? Nobody would suggest that, right? And also, just because something has teeth doesn't mean that is something just distinct to reptiles. There are reptiles that don't have teeth, right? Like turtles, right? So, you know, to say that just because he has those two means that it's distinctly reptilian is not true. But then, with further evidence came out that these wings are fully developed, and they're just like feathers that we would have today. And the teeth are very unlike reptile teeth, and so you couldn't really make a watertight argument with that either. And let me just say, these are two that have been purported that have been shown wrong. Where are the millions that ought to be here? I mean, we have millions of fossils. I don't want to just see one. I want to see several, right? And so, obviously, the fossil record is far short of showing that there was this gradual, ascending in complexity between lower forms of animals to more complex animals. It's just not there. There's no, where are the intermediate forms? We have some crystallized, if you look over, we have some insects that are, the next page, that have been crystallized in amber. They're just as fully developed and look exactly like and function exactly like the insects that we have today. And you see here the shift that they say that this went through from fish to bird. That's how the artists draw it. And over here on the right, this is an older chart because the more that they've studied, the more billions of years they've had to add to this because they recognize it can't happen in millions of years. But you find that they have these invertebrates that I talked about, and we're going to talk about the trilobite here in a little bit tonight. He's the middle one there at the bottom. And they brought forth fishes and amphibians and then primitive reptiles and dinosaurs and mammals. And something, maybe I haven't examined this enough, but something I wonder about is when we get to this next one is natural selection. That's the engine behind all of this, that Darwin suggested that the survival of the fittest, right? The ones that are more fit will survive. The ones that are less fit, they won't produce as much and they'll die out. Well, if it's the case that evolution keeps marching on, then why do we still have reptiles today? I mean, if they weren't fit enough that you had a higher development, maybe I'm oversimplifying the matter, but I don't get that. And why don't we have an intermediate, form like we talked about today, something that's evolving into something else? And even with things in the past, like dinosaurs, all the dinosaur bones we've ever dug up, were there any intermediate forms between, like, we all know that the pterodactyl that flies, right? And some were herbivores, some were carnivores, right? We know about all that. We don't have any fossil evidence that shows how they developed and how, they had common ancestors. We all find that they are different, species of them. How is it that this one can fly and this one walks on the land and this one eats this and this one eats that? And there's no middle ground in a lot of those. So the evidence really just is not there. But then this survival of the fittest. Very interesting thing. Survival of the fittest, and a lot of evolutionists will have started to speak out and said this, what I'm saying here in letter B here, is that survival of the fittest doesn't explain how you get a new species or a new kind of animal. And a good quote that is going to be in the reading that's assigned is, survival of the fittest can explain the maintenance, how you maintain a species, but it can't explain how you arrive at one. Okay? It can explain how it survives, but it can't explain how it arrives. And I guess what I mean by that is this. What is meant by that is this. What they've said throughout all of this is, well, the ones that are the most fit are going to survive. The ones that are not as fit are going to die out. And so then we ask the question, well, how do you determine which ones are the most fit? And what's their answer for that? Well, the ones that survive. Well, how do you, what are the ones that survive? Well, the ones that are the most fit. It's a very circular argument, you see. If you take the evolutionary model and you impose it on to what the world has as far as the animal kingdom is concerned, then obviously it's going to fit the model, because you're going to say these are the most fit because they've survived. Well, how do we know that there's why are they? So it's really a kind of a tautology. It's really kind of a circular reasoning, and it doesn't really explain how you would get a new species to begin with. Thirdly, we have mutations, because evolutionists saw that survival of the fittest really wasn't going to do it, really couldn't explain it, and they had all this ground to make up, and they kept adding billions of years, but they still couldn't add it all up just strictly with the natural order of things, the way things are supposed to go. They say, well, maybe the mutations would do it. You know, a mutation would cause a jump, a leap in time, in this progress, this chain of progress, right? We've all heard of X-Men, right? And the whole basis behind X-Men is every few eons, there's some mutants that leap forward in evolution, right? And they, so that's the whole basis behind that. Well, that's an evolutionary idea. Well, when you really get to look at mutations, and the study of genetics was not, existent when Darwin was alive. But when you start to study genetics and you look at mutations, first of all, they are very rare, quite rare. But on top of that, mutations don't add any genetic information. It is a duplication or a deletion of certain genetic information. And so it's not like I can, it's like me saying, okay, I'm going to take water and pour it on this book, or pour it on this ink and spread it around. Now, some of the words are going to be smeared and I'm not going to be able to read them. But who here would believe that new words and new information are going to be formed and added to that? That's just not the way it works. It is either a recopying or it's a deletion of the DNA information. And so it's not going to add anything. Most of them are harmful. Most of them are bad. Things like, when you think about things that might be a little more common as far as mutations that we're acquainted with, for instance, something like Down syndrome, right? You think somebody that has Down syndrome is more fit to survive, according to the evolutionary model? The different things like that, where the genetic information has a problem with it. So, first of all, very rare. Second of all, mostly harmful. Some of them are neutral. They don't really change much. But it is very, very rare. You know, less than 1% of them would actually help or benefit in any way. And then on top of that, you'd have to have their offspring benefit from that. And so it's basically impossible when you, add it up scientifically. So mutations won't work. And then also, the idea of going from simple to complex is impossible to do if you want to do it consistently. Right? Because go back to this this handout that I have. Going back to Mr. Trilobite here, was Greg, were you telling me you learned about the trilobites in school? I learned about them. Little trilobites. Then invertebrates kind of looks like this, and has these, these nice eyes up here.
Yeah.
Well, if you look in this, the periods of time here, trilobites are pretty far down on the list, right? They're invertebrates. Well, the interesting thing is that the eyes of the trilobite are more complex than many of the things that are above it. So how do you determine complexity? Some things are much more complex than others depending on what aspect of the animal you're talking about, right? For instance, there are lower forms of life, according to the model, that can see in color, right? But then we know higher forms of life, like land creatures that would have come later, like dogs and, I think cattle, can't see in color, right? They don't have the rods and the cones. So why would it be the case that they would develop this and then lose it and then develop it again? So how do you take something from simple to complex? Because those invertebrates in a lot of ways are more complex than we are. And so this whole idea of it just gradually gets more complex, no, it doesn't really fit that way. Some of them are much more complex in some ways, and they're worse. I mean, if the eagle came before us, why does we have such poor eyesight compared to him? So you think about all of trying to put all this together, really it's a mess. There's no way it'll work.
Is the argument that those did not exist at the same time as man, though? Those were millions of years before man, right?
Yeah.
But yet there's a fossil of a shoe, this is one of Brad Ayers' things when he's here, of one on the bottom of the sandal where it's squashed by the man's sandal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Down in a coal field, I think.
Right.
A coal bed, so.
Well, the last page I have here is the fossilization means swift burial. And before we talk about that, I do want to mention what you're talking about. The idea of something being like somebody's shoe being buried. When geologists dig down into the earth, there's these different layers called different strata, right? That have different types of sediment in them, right? And what they use as a basis of a proof for this is that you find these things like the trilobite down here, right? So Mr. Trilobite's there. And then you find things that are a little more complex, like a fish would be here. Then you find some amphibians and some reptiles and some mammals. And at the very top, you know, so it goes from what we would think less complex to more complex, right? Well, there's a lot of problems with this, because I say that this, basically they say that it's been taking millions of years for this to take place. It's a slow process. It's kind of like when they go to the Grand Canyon and they say, well, it took 5 years to grow an inch, and so that means that it had to have taken, 5 billion years for this to... They're assuming that things grow at the same rate or shrink at the same rate. You know, they're assuming that that's all the same. But really that won't fit because, like you pointed out, Brad Harrop has many examples of things that are polystrate fossils. What he means by that is many different strata. Like a tree. You have a tree here that, you know, with its leaves and everything, and it's fossilized in two or three different layers. Now, is a tree going to hang around for billions of years while it's waiting to be fossilized, or is it going to rot and decay over that great period of time? And so, obviously, these fossils, when they were fossilized, they happened very quickly, right? That's why you don't have... That's why, for instance, if a fish dies today, does it become a fossil? Usually?
No.
Usually it's fish food, right? It's picked apart by other fish. So obviously it's not a slow process. It's something that happened immediately. Almost like in a universal catastrophe like the flood, right? And it's very evident of that. For instance, if we were going to have a flood today, a universal flood like in the day of Noah, okay, if it's going to happen on Earth today, and all the world would be covered, and because of the springs of the deep would be coming up and the water from above, it would drastically, obviously the flood drastically changed the landscape of this earth, right? You have a lot of dirt and sediment moving all over the place, right? Well, what's going to be at the bottom? You go to the bottom parts of the ocean, you're going to have these invertebrates, right? What's going to be closer to the top of the water? Fish. What's going to be fossilized next, in the next layer? Amphibians, things that need to be near the water, right? What's going to come next? Reptiles. Then on top of that, what's going to come next? Well, things like wolves and deer. And what's going to be at the very top? Well, man, who's intelligent enough to get up to the mountains, right? But finally, is buried under these. So, you see, it's not from simple to complex. It's just simply where they were when this took place. You know, and here's the example. Like this first picture, top left, his fish was buried before it finished finished its breakfast. This ichthyosaur was fossilized while giving birth. Now, you all should really listen to what Brad Harrop has to say. He's a doctor, and I obviously don't know squat about this, but you can see from these pictures that this is not something that happened over billions of years. It happened quickly. You know, they were taken by surprise. It was some catastrophe that caused this to take place. And so this really all points to the flood of the Bible, right?
Yes.
People say Grand Canyon had to take billions of years to form. First of all, you don't know the way that it was formed to begin with, you know, the way that the earth was formed to begin with. But we have many examples of huge canyons being created with a river flowing through them, like, you know, the river Colorado does there, that have been formed in very short periods of time, just because of all the water coming down and gravity and the movement of it all. And so to assume that just because it's expanding or contracting at a certain, like an inch every 5 years, to assume that it's always done that, when we're just looking at this small portion, you know, that's making a huge assumption and really a big mistake. And that's what the problem with all this is that there's really no science to origins, in a sense, because you can't observe. Science is it's a study that is given to observation. And when you start making interpreting things according to this model or theory that you have, and the only reason that we know that the rocks are this old is because they have to take this long to develop, and the only reason we do that is because we have the evolutionary model, you know, a lot of circular reasoning, you're getting out of your field. Scientists are getting out of their field when they do that. So the idea of simple to complex simply won't work. There are several different examples of things that have much more complex parts that won't work. Now, there is this term that I don't have defined for you, but it's called things that are called irreducibly complex. And what we mean by that is there are certain parts in our bodies and in different creatures that work together. Like I was talking to you about the giraffe and the woodpecker, that they would have to somehow develop over millions of years, and they couldn't work together until they were both fully developed, but somehow they all developed at the same time and were able to work. A good example is our eye, right? The light goes into the pupil of your eye, and maybe we should brought Brad in to talk to us about this, but the lens of your eye focuses that light to the back part of your eye where the retina receives it. And there are rods and cones there that, you know, that receive all that light and interpret that, and they send it up through the optical nerve. Now, how in the world are all those going to develop and work? And be able to work once they do, because you're going to have a lens developing at the same time. You're going to have a retina and a pupil and an optical nerve all developing and somehow all working. Starting to work at the same point. If it didn't work, it would really be more of a hindrance to survival of the fittest, right? For instance, suppose an arm is 80% evolved, right? We're going along, we're developing arms, right? And we have several generations with these arms that are hanging here that are 80% developed. Can't really do anything with them. Do you think that's going to help us be more fit for survival, or is it going to slow us down? Wouldn't they die out unless it's completely developed? And so there's a lot of things like that just really won't work. And I have here, there's many other items to which evolution can't provide an answer. The problem is not with the evidence. The problem is with the interpretation of the evidence. Scientists have the idea because it's what is considered educated, it's what the smart people believe. They have the idea that it has to fall into this general theory of evolution. And so therefore, all of the evidence they try to take and apply to that, instead of looking at it honestly and seeing how it fits really better with what the Bible says. It's like somebody that tries to go to the Bible and justify what they want to do, instead of changing their life to fit the Bible. So instead of going to the evidence and trying to figure out what it warrants and what it points to, they try to turn it and twist it and bend it in order to fit the developed theory that they have. Does anybody have any comments or questions on this before we stop for tonight?
I think that one example of two is the chromosome count. You think the chromosomes would generally get higher, for an animal, the specimen, but a bat has more chromosomes than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And the chain that they teach, the bat would be before man. So.
Yeah. Yeah, like in different ways like that. I mean, we're closer to some than others. There's I think his name was Thomas Morgan. He worked with flies. And you ask, why would you want to do that? Well, first of all, they are easy to store, much more than like horses, right? And second of all, they reproduce in about 2 weeks. And he tried this with mutations. He even was not just letting nature take place, but he was trying to change the fruit flies. And he spent over 50 years of his life. Now you think about how many two-week span times, and he probably could have been having multiple batches going at the same time. And all that he ever produced were flies. That's all he ever did. And he was one of the ones that really started speaking out about this, and you know, and even when he tried to control the mutations to do something, usually they were all bad, and he couldn't even with trying get what he wanted to get done. And so here you have an example of generations after generations of these flies, and all that is produced were flies. He could try to control colors of certain things and do little things specifically like we're talking about. But as far as adding information or making them become better, it didn't work out. And so that should show that certainly nature is not going to do it, no matter how much time you give it. You think about how complex the genetic code is. I mean, it's not just... I mean, it'd be like saying that an explosion of ink just causes an encyclopedia, whole Encyclopedia Britannica to just come together. You know, that's maybe a fair representation of how complex it is, and that every word and every letter would be exactly in the right place, every spot of ink right in the exact place. That's comparable to how complex our genetic code is, and the idea that it could just arrange for that for us to survive, based on all the different myriads of options that would cause us to die, really doesn't work. Like, I was reading something about clotting, the enzymes and the proteins in your blood, mm-hmm. and things like that cause your blood to clot. And you think any experimentation with this, you're either going to bleed to death or you're going to clot to death. You know, what is it that causes, the only reason the proteins are there is because of the enzymes, the only reason the enzymes are there is because of the proteins. And they're causing it to start clotting, to stop, it stops at a certain point. All of that. How does that develop? Just by mere chance. And somehow surviving it at the same time. And you got to remember, not only is it developing, but they have to be workable. It has to survive this whole time. It's like saying, let's take a sentence that's 50 miles long, and we're going to change one letter. And that sentence that's 50 miles long, and it has to make sense. And change another letter. And we're going to change absolutely every letter in that. And all along the way, it has to make sense to us. Like, they have to be actual words that have meaning. You know how hard that would be? I mean, the longer the sentence gets, right, the harder it's going to be. And that's maybe a similar thing to what this would have to be. Just all by time and chance. Foolishness. Anybody have anything else? All right. I'll let you go. Oh, by the way, your reading, required reading.